Translation to both verses, 68 and 69, is as follows. Seeing the condition of the world, he began to think seriously of how all these people could be delivered from the clutches of Maya. Srila Dvaitacharya Prabhu thought, quote, if Krishna himself appears to distribute the cult of devotional service, then only will liberation be possible for all people. End quote. Short purport by Srila Prabhupada. Just as a condemned person can be relieved by a special favor of the chief executive head, the president or king, so the condemned people of this Kali Yuga can be delivered only by the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, or a person especially empowered for this purpose. Srila Dvaitacharya Prabhu desired that the Supreme Personality of Godhead advent himself to deliver the fallen souls of this age. Om Agyana Timirandasya Ginanjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Mukham Karati Vachalam Pangum Langati Girim Yat Kripa Tamam Vande Shri Gurum Dinataranam Panchakalpatirubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyaiva cha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Ten to nine.
Oh, there's extra time, you're saying? Yeah. Okay, thank you. Usually when I lecture, I bring 2,000 notes and stuff, and there's usually just a little tiny little table. Okay, I'll just close the book then. So what we're hearing here is, well, actually, I think it'd be appropriate to introduce myself. This is my first visit to Manor, and only once before I visited England, and that was in 1999, and at that time I visited Soho Street Temple. So, obviously, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for your company. I was born and I grew up in Croatia. That's where I met devotees. As a matter of fact, I was 13 when I got the first book by Srila Prabhupada. Actually, it was several books. Life Comes from Life. I remember reading that book, and I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it. I was laughing a lot while reading it. I remember hitting with my fist against the table. I was very happy. Ha, ha, ha. Then when I was 14, I discovered Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavatam. The whole set was given to me by a friend, a girl, whose mom bought a whole Bhagavatam set on the street from a devotee. It's not that devotees every day walk in the street with a full Bhagavatam set. So that was a bit of a miracle, I thought. And then later on, when I finished high school, I went to visit a temple, and I thought I was going to stay just for the weekend, but it turned out to be 2 weeks, then 3 months, and then that was it. So that pretty much summarizes my life story. Actually, at one point, I moved to the States. Actually, went there to visit and to do a particular service I was invited to do. It was supposed to take about a year. And then after finishing that, I was invited from Portland down to Los Angeles. So I went to LA and I spent about 4 years there. for the most part, training new bhaktas. That was my service. Then I went to San Diego, built up a brahmacharya ashram. We had 40 brahmacharis, started from a scratch. That was, I'm not sure what's the situation like in UK, but in America, that's a miracle. And then they made me the temple president. So I rendered that service for about 10 years until I took sannyas about a few hours ago, a few months ago. And my Guru Maharaj gave me name Tirtha, not Swami. Swami is also a name, not a title. So in my case, it goes before the name. Yeah, in the case of Satchinandana Swami, Swami to him is not a title. To him, that's a name. His name is Swami. My name is Tirtha. Just a detail, yeah. So, what we're hearing here in Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, this section, is that Srila Advaita Acharya looked at the situation in Navadvipa area at the time, and he thought that, as they say in America, when something is really bad, only God can help you. So that's how he felt about the situation, that only God can help here. And so now this is actually, this is very, not just interesting, but this is very important. This is very important. And specifically how it is important, I shall not reveal right away, otherwise I will have spoiled my presentation. So, the challenge I put before myself here is to put few things in historic context, and then we'll come back to Chaitanya Charitamrita, to this important thing that we're hearing about in the book. Oh, that's just an age-old battle, man versus machine. It's hard to tell who's winning. Just a brief history of human race. No, just kidding. But few details. From the modern point of view, there are primitive societies. And they're considered primitive because of the means of production. In other words, the way they secure things for themselves, stuff they need. So in other words, the way people go about their economy will define, according to modern people, and they're pretty much accurate about it, they will define certain aspects of a society. And so from modern point of view, the most primitive societies, according to their economic system, are the hunters and gatherers. So this is one group, hunters and gatherers. These are people who don't own much, are very nearly constantly on the move, and they secure their needs by hunting or gathering, like picking, like Lord Ramachandra when he was in the forest, he was just picking herbs and fruits, roots, leaves, etc., like that. And he moved all the time. And so these are considered most primitive. Why most primitive? Because it takes a lot of effort to produce something. It takes a lot of effort to produce something. And a little better than this economic system is considered agrarian system, where people actually settle down somewhere and then grow stuff. Maybe I should say food. You never know what people think of stuff these days. And they grow food. And because they're in one place, they can plant a lot of food in one place and cultivate it. And so production is much more plentiful. But nothing compares to industrial system. Industrial system means you're producing like crazy. It takes very little time to produce something. Not too long ago, about a month ago, I was in Siberia. And there I saw a table, kitchen table made by hand. It was a very beautiful table made by hand. And it took months for this person to make this table. Now, how much would a thing in modern society cost if it took months to produce? A lot. How long does it take? Does Britain produce any vehicles? What's the company?
Vauxhall.
With V? Okay. How long does it take him to produce the simplest, most simple vehicle in their most simple vehicle? About 6 hours, and then about 2 minutes for each following one. That's very fast. So the production, it's huge. And all this change started with the Industrial Revolution. And there were two waves of Industrial Revolution, first wave and then the second wave. And the first wave, people thought, now we're going to eradicate hunger, because now we can produce stuff really fast. And then with the second wave of Industrial Revolution, people started to produce machines, like metal machines. I know people nowadays, I have a hard time conceiving of a world of life before cell phones, but try to imagine a world without machines. It was a very different world. So to invent, it was a revolution when the printer was invented. It changed society tremendously, just like the invention of internet changed psychology of people, their culture, its economy, all kinds of things it changed. So at this point, they started to make machines, and this was very exciting times for people. People talked a lot about, because of large production, they would have to work just a little bit. Even though now we know it's not true. Even though we're producing a lot, some or other, we're working more than ever. For example, the hunters and gatherers, the most simple, more simply organized society. I was just reading a book recently, so it's on my mind. It's called The Original Affluent Society. On an average, the workday was between 1 and 3 hours. What's the average workday these days in England? A day? 50, 60, that's a week. A day, yeah. 8, 9, 7. Okay, at least 3 times more, at least. And yet the production increased way more than 3 or 4 times. It increased thousandfold. And yet we're working so much more. Interesting. Interestingly. I'll read that later. I have a really juicy quote by Srila Prabhupada in this regard, waiting to be read here, screaming. Now, what's interesting about this is that this was very exciting time for Europeans. They went all over, British went all over the world, basically torturing people, but occupying countries and conquering horizons and expanding their influence. And it was very, all kinds of things are happening in Europe. Science. Scientific view of the world, collapse of dogmatic religion, the age of reason, Thomas Paine, what's that movement? I forget their name. Age of reason. Humanists? No. The age of enlightenment. Who said that? Thank you. Thank you. Oh, you won. age of enlightenment. In other words, people started to look, religion changed. You know, the religious dogma did not fly anymore. Very exciting times in Europe. But with it, with all this, primarily with all this production, something started to change in Europe. And then later on all over the world. And then fast forward to present, this thing was not good. It was a really not good thing. And this is that slowly people were more interested, more, they got caught up in the frenzy of production. And so the thrill made people value pleasure much more than truth. If you look, for example, in modern society, what's the position of philosophy at any universe? At least, of course, I'm speaking about America. I'm not sure what's it like in England, because, again, this is my second visit, and the last one was 17 years ago. So, but I assume it's very much the same. What is the position of philosophy at any university? I mean, they're struggling to get kids to sign up for their courses, let alone to decide to major in philosophy. It just has no, like religion in modern times, philosophy has been delegated to private life. Disneyland is much more important than philosophy. As a matter of fact, philosophy and religion became a form of a Disneyland. In other words, the value of religion and philosophy is not knowledge, is not seeking truth, but it's seeking pleasure. And in America, they even say like this: if it works for you, if it makes you feel good, good for you. What a way to evaluate a system of knowledge, by how much pleasure it gives you rather than by how consistent it is. And so, true, I mean, but what's going on all over the world is, some call it Americanization, and there's some truth to it, but it really, we can't really just point fingers to America. It's really going all over the place. But America seems to be leading the way here, and so being an influential country, therefore other people are influenced by this kind of thinking. And so in America, for example, there's so much discussion, for example, as to what defines someone's gender. In other words, people are not happy with how biologically their gender is defined, but rather how I feel about it. If I don't feel like a male, why should you or biology or anyone impose on me maleness? To me, this is extremely funny, if not sad. But in an average American mind, this is a serious question. In other words, this seeking of pleasure has reached heights that I could have never imagined. Instead of thinking how to detect the truth, the reality, the ultimate truth, and then subordinate ourselves to it, the type of thinking is, how can I subordinate that darn thing to my likes? But I never could care less whether I'm a man or a woman. I mean, like, whatever, you know. Some or other, I got thrown into a male body, just run with it. What shall I do now? Never thought about it. And then you have all these, there's a whole lot of movements which, I mean, they're quite vulgar, so I won't mention their names. Even their name is vulgar. But the whole idea is that that these people want to go around undressed, naked. That why should their bodies be stigmatized? If they feel like going around naked, they should be allowed to do that. And so if you think about what's wrong with this, what's wrong with this is that there's something very peculiar that happens to a human being when a human being runs into human anatomy, especially if it's the human anatomy of the opposite sex. Or even in the case of homosexuals, the same sex, but the same principle works. And that is that our lust and our greed, our selfishness tremendously increases. And so in the Bhagavad Gita, right, Krishna says, avritam jnana metena, that there is something which covers knowledge. And what is that which tremendously covers knowledge and which Krishna describes to be the worst enemy of one who wants to be in knowledge? Maya, sure. More specifically, kama, right, lust. And lust is what, there's nothing wrong with human anatomy. Human anatomy is as normal as anything else, as a tree. But what is not normal is how we tend to respond when we run into human anatomy. If we responded to trees in the same way, we would have clothing for trees. But we don't respond psychologically in the same way when we meet the trees, in the same way when we meet human anatomy. And so therefore every society thinking, every traditional society thus far, thinking that edifying society is important, therefore was always greatly concerned about how to deal with human anatomy or exposition of it. And so clothing, covering, fashion is fine. We find fashion everywhere. That's just nice. But for these reasons, clothing has other functions too. And this is to prevent society from separating itself from the path of knowledge. And these people never, I don't quite follow everything, but if you spend some time in the States, you just cannot avoid it. It's all over the place. You're walking down the street and there it is, the movement, free the something movement. What's really interesting about it to me is that these people never think, at least never express their never answer to this concern. What are we, if we're going to undress ourselves? What about the concern of these other people who are interested in knowledge and edification? I want to be free to walk around nude. This is the pinnacle. And it all, of course, it's hard to say when did it all start. But if you look back at this history, this industrial revolution, it really, really bewildered humanity. And what's interesting, when people started to invent, like the first British guy invented this spinning thing for cloth, some say that was the beginning of industrial revolution, right? I have no clue, but thank you. Did he stop to think, oh my God, maybe this is not good. Maybe I should hide this from people. Did the people who got caught in the frenzy of creating machines, were they thinking, oh my goodness, this might be dangerous? No, they're all caught up in the frenzy of it. My goodness, look what we can create. Look what we can do with these machines. Of course, what did the Europeans do with their machines? They went around the world and enslaved a bunch of people, nations, civilizations, etc. Anyhow, some other time about that. So, So in this way, for this reason, Srila Prabhupada described modern society as a headless body. And he thought that that ISKCON should create the head for the headless body. Srila Prabhupada thought that the body is there, but it's lacking head. Specifically, head is the brahminical element of the society. The element that's not confused with the frenzy of production or consumption. But this is a section of the society, people within the society who are sober, who manage to stay sober through all of this stuff. This is the head. And Srila Prabhupada wanted to create this head and then put it on the headless body. So that the body can go in the right direction. As it is, it's just flapping and running and, man, doing all kinds of stuff. So, headless body. Last year I shot a short film and never published it. Waiting for someone to put music to it. If there are any musicians here who would like to write music for a film, let me know. It's about a 5-minute long film. But it's a film about the person who takes a ladder and runs with the ladder, sets it on the wall, and it's a really nice ladder. And he climbs up the ladder and he comes down and goes up and down in all kinds of wonderful ways. And then once it's up on the wall, he looks left, looks right, looks straight and says, "Oh my goodness, I climbed the wrong wall." So this is very much what the modern society is like. It's running, it's spinning, it's jumping, it's climbing, but it has never decided, never thought to even discuss what is the wall worth climbing. As I can't remember where I read this, but it's been some months, maybe even, I hope not years, I hope I'm not that delusional about time, but it's been some time, and I read it, and if I could remember where I read it, I would give the author due credit, but I cannot remember, so whoever you are, I apologize. This person said that describing this kind of civilization, he described it as improved means to an unimproved end. We're constantly improving means, but have never thought to improve the end. As a matter of fact, probably never thought about what is the good end. Improved means to an unimproved end. I thought this was a really juicy description of the times we live in. And here comes a quote from Srila Prabhupada. This is a very intense quote, so please don't cringe. And this is not from a letter, not from a conversation, not something Prabhupada did in private. Prabhupada printed this in the Srimad Bhagavatam, which he wanted us to distribute to everyone. So here it goes. "Demons are very much interested in advancing a plan by which people will labor hard like cats, dogs, and hogs. But Krishna's devotees want to teach Krishna consciousness so that people will be satisfied with plain living and Krishna conscious advancement. Although demons have created many plans for industry and hard labor, so that people will work day and night like animals, this is not the purpose of civilization. Such endeavors are jagato ahitaha, that is, they are meant for the misfortune of the people in general. Kshayaya, such activities lead to annihilation. One who understands the purpose of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, should seriously understand the importance of the Krishna consciousness movement and seriously take part in it. One should not endeavor for ugra karma or unnecessary work for sense gratification. Srila Prabhupada so badly wanted us and everyone else to understand this. And therefore, not only practice Krishna consciousness, but teach Krishna consciousness. Give Krishna consciousness to others, which includes this lifestyle, which includes this social organization. Now, okay, just really quick about moral reasoning. Moral reasoning is just a fancy-schmancy technical term for deciding what is good and what is bad. Basically, every time we ask ourselves, is this good or is this bad, we're morally reasoning. And so, there are different types of moral reasoning, blah, blah, blah. But I shall just mention two. One is consequentialism, the other one is deontology. So consequentialism tells you that the value of an act, whether act is a good or bad, is understood not by just looking at the act itself, but by looking at the consequences of the act. So in other words, when you see what the act produces, you can understand the moral value of the act. And deontology claims that the moral value of the act is found within the act itself. And you find this all over the place. A whole lot of people take a vow never to tell a lie because they consider that telling a lie is immoral. So under all circumstances, these kind of people will never tell a lie. They'll always tell truth because they think that intrinsically being truthful, this is deontology, is always good. Now, reality is neither one or the other. It's really a bit of both. And interestingly enough, throughout history, there's been people thinking one way or the other. But if we, just by reading Bhagavad Gita, it becomes immediately obvious that you have one and the other. So, I think I'll do that later. There are two problems with consequentialism. And I'll come back to that. There are two problems with consequentialism. And one problem is, so if consequentialism is moral reasoning, where you're trying to tell the value of an act, such as inventing a machine, for you to understand whether this is good or bad, you have to consider the consequences, right? This is consequentialism. Now, there are two problems with consequentialism. In other words, two problems which make it difficult to tell by this system whether the act is actually good or bad. Can anyone think of one? Just to engage you a bit, so it's not just me here talking. Correct. It is very difficult to predict the consequences. And especially, it is difficult to predict ultimate consequences. Because the way things work, you have an act which produces a reaction, produces something, which in turn will produce something else, which in turn will result in something else, which in turn will result in something else. And so as you thought you were headed that way, you ended up going this way. Very good. It's hard to tell how many of these people could predict that there would be Free the Nipple movement. There you go, I said it, sorry. The other problem with consequentialism is that even if we were able to tell, even if we were to be able to tell what the ultimate outcome would be, we would still have to decide whether that is truly a good thing. Social conditioning, cultural conditioning, blah, 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 because these are just some of the reasons for which we may consider bad thing good or good thing bad. Of course, when it comes to discussion of Vedic culture, what is Vedic culture, etc., etc., but amongst Western devotees, there's sometimes huge resistance towards elements of Vedic culture, for example, which are largely results of cultural conditioning. Just one little detail. I'm not here to get into social issues discussion, but just as to demonstrate a principle, how not only that it is difficult to tell what the ultimate outcome is going to be, but it is also difficult to tell what is the wanted outcome. And for these reasons, deontology has value. A typical example given to discredit deontology is that story given in Mahabharata where a Brahmin took a vow of never speaking a lie, a vow of truthfulness. And so a person ran into his ashram all disturbed, seeking his protection and shelter. And so he hid him. He said that there were some people, bad people, after him who want to kill him. Can you hide me? Yes, hide over here. Then the bad people come into the ashram. Have you seen a person we're after? Yes, I have. Where is he? He's right there. Never tell a lie, right? And it says there that he went to hell. In other words, in those kind of circumstances, he should have told the lie. So the point is that one anomaly is that we have deontology exclusive of consequentialism. In other words, that we simply follow something. It is always good to give charity. It is always good to be truthful. It is always good, and the list goes on. But no, sometimes you have to think. And in the Bhagavad Gita, 18th chapter, 23, 4, something like maybe 7, I can't remember. There's a verse where Krishna says that one who engages in activities without considering the consequences of those activities in terms of bondage, pain, etc., etc., such a person acts in the mode of ignorance. So that's deontology exclusive of consequentialism as taught by Krishna. Now, but then you have also consequentialism, which is exclusive of deontology as given by Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, is a serious mental speculation. In other words, every time all of us who are claiming to be as Vaishnavas or aspiring Vaishnavas, when we morally reason where we need to go, how we need to get there, what is good, what is bad, we ought to think only within the terms, within the purview of Guru, Sadhu, and most importantly, Shastra. Because Guru and Sadhu simply means the teaching that which is in the Shastra. Guru and Sadhu do not teach what's in the Shastra are neither Guru nor Sadhu. And this is very, very important. When we don't do this, we become atheists. Atheist is a person who does not believe, does not trust God, but trusts his own speculations. And we see that humanity, I just gave a little one example of Industrial Revolution. We see throughout history is replete with humans rejecting the guidance of God and making unlimited mistakes. Unlimited mistakes. According to Krishna, we ought to live simply, not this complicated modern economic system, but a simple economic system. Hunterers? No. Gatherers? Okay. We ought not to hunt, but we can gather roots, flowers, fruits, etc. In agriculture, industrial system is not good. Because where it takes people, it's not good. And so literally when Advaita Acharya says only God can help, he is so right. He is so seriously right. Only God can help. And pure devotees. And those were short of being pure devotees. To that extent, What's his name? Okay, don't make me laugh now. We'll talk later. Sorry about the disturbance, but... Now my mind took off, trying to remember his name. Okay, come back. In the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's that verse, Krishne Svadham Upagate, right? That now that Krishna has departed from this world is setting into darkness. There's no hope for this world. These are not mere sentimental statements. These are serious philosophical propositions. And what is there to replace Krishna? According to that verse, Srimad Bhagavatam. This Bhagavat Purana is here to replace Krishna. And so Advaita Acharya's attitude that only God can help here is very, very, very true. And part of being a theist, is to come to doubt our own intellectual, mental, etc. abilities. And to trust God and pure devotees for guidance. In some ways, Krishna consciousness begins, seriously begins, when one has accepted a spiritual master. Not just become initiated, but accepted spiritual master. So, I shall stop here. Om Tat Sat. And if there are any questions or comments...